funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How important are blogs to modern culture, and do they enhance or detract from the offerings of traditional media sources? Although children born around the time of the first blogs are just getting old enough for their learner's permits, cultural critics have warned more than once about the imminent demise of blogging in the face of newer forms of online expression like Facebook, Twitter, and even YouTube. But that news does not seem to have spread to the millions of Americans who write and the hundreds of millions who read blog entries on a regular basis. So what function do blogs serve, and how has the form evolved over its short but eventful life history? Scott Rosenberg is a co-founder and former managing editor of Salon.com and a blogger himself at WordYard.com. His new book is called Say Everything: How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much.
You write that throughout the time blogs have existed as we know them today, the debate over their value has been this sort of tug of war between cynics and idealists. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, the blogging began in the late 90s, basically. The term came into use then, and that was at the height of the dot-com bubble, as you'll recall, and there was this sort of explosion of interest in the web, but there was this real tension between the idea that the web was just waiting for big companies to come along and tame it and turn it into something like television, and other people who said, no, wait a minute, you know, this is a totally different environment. This is an environment in which anyone can contribute. And at the very beginning, it was a theoretical notion that anyone could contribute because it was still pretty hard to create your own website. What blogging did was sort of open the floodgates, made it easy and essentially free for anyone to express themselves on the web. And that was the moment at which the sort of, I like to think that the idealist point of view there kind of won out, and people could see that, in fact, the web was not going to be just another kind of television, just this outlet for large corporations. It was really going to be something different.
Yeah, and the interactivity of blogs has always been different from the kind of interactivity that was envisioned by the first sort of corporate webmasters who did see that mediated place on the web as being the heart and soul of things.
You know, in the earliest days of the web, I built my first website in 1994. We started Salon in 1995, so my perspective goes pretty far back. And I can still remember when the word interactivity meant a website would give you a picture and you could click on different points of the picture, and they felt, see, we're being interactive. And at that time, I thought, you know what, interactivity is really when somebody sends me an email and I get to respond and there's actually a dialogue. It's not very high tech, but that's interactivity. And what happened was that idea that, you know, interactivity is just people being able to have a two-way engagement with their sources of media, that idea really came to full fruit with blogging.
This sounds, I know, like a simplistic question, Scott, but maybe we need to begin this with a good working definition of what is and what is not a blog for purposes of our discussion.
Yeah, and it turns out not to be so simple a question. The good, quick answer is that a blog is a personal website usually, though not exclusively, put out by one person, in which there are lots of short items and the newest items go at the top of the page. And that's really it. So it's really just a form. It's a definition of the shape of a website. And it's gotten more complicated over the years because the form has been adopted now by lots of professional media, so that I think you go to the New York Times website and they have something like 70 blogs there, they also have editors still. And the old fashioned blog was a site that had no editor. One early blogger's definition of blogging was that it's the unedited voice of a person, and so the definitions have kind of gotten looser over time, but really simple. One person, short items, new stuff at the top. That's a good good place to start.
Yeah, well, one thing I really like about the book is that it reminds us, you know, we're in this place now where we can't remember what we didn't have a year ago because it all seems to have been here forever. But there was a time when everybody was deciding what to do with new content, because it used to be that websites were sort of built and allowed to sit there for a while and you'd go back every few months. And
right.
That's certainly not the case now.
Right. I remember still, and you may too, the websites where when they added something new, there would be a little icon that flashed yellow or red and said new.
Yeah, a little date bug or something.
And
yeah.
and that was fine, except new to whom? You know, mm-hmm. New since when? It didn't actually make a lot of sense. And when the blog form began to be adopted, it was very effective because you always knew that you could start reading at the top of the page and you could go down until you started reading stuff that you'd already read before. And then you knew you were done. But it also had to overcome the fear or the idea that a lot of early publishers on the web had, which was that people wouldn't scroll. They thought they had to put everything that mattered in that top screen. And what, you know, pretty much everyone has learned how to scroll. That turns out not to be that big an issue.
Talk for a minute about the motivation of sort of citizen bloggers who aren't taking a paycheck home for this, for writing.
Well, you know, we think of the coverage of blogging has been a little distorted because, of course, the coverage from blogging of blogging in the media is created by people who are media professionals. And so they look at blogs and they see something that looks kind of like what they do. The website, a blog site and a professional media site, you know, they're not as different, say, as amateur TV and professional TV would be. But it turns out that most bloggers are not actually dreaming of becoming mass media outlets themselves. Most of them are motivated by very personal reasons. They want to express something. They feel that they can figure out what they think about things by writing about them in public, or they have stories from their lives that they want to tell, even if they're only going to reach just a few friends or relatives, that's okay. There's a personal reward in what they do. And that's enough. They're not sitting there, you know, checking how they're doing on the charts.
And some of this boils down to the distinction of whether people who sit down to write are thinking about what their audience wants to read or thinking about exactly what they want to say.
Well, so if you're in the media business, you have to think about what people want to read. Part of an editor's job is kind of craftily, but accurately, it's assembling an audience to sell to advertisers. That's what a media business has traditionally done. And if you're not if you're not trying to sell eyeballs to advertisers, that piece of it kind of drops away. Now, most writers do want their work to be read, and most bloggers, you know, are happier if they're reaching more people. But they're really free to pursue their own passions and to go deep into subjects. You know, one of the great successes of blogging has been going really deep into subjects that are too arcane, even for the most, the best public radio stations and the best newspapers, so that if you really want to understand, what's happening in the legal profession, you really want to understand the arguments over copyright or, the economic debate over what's happened in the economy over the last year and a half, there are blogs that will go into great depth that will teach you enormously about these subjects and that will let you see alternative points of view, because, of course, they're also linking. The other big feature of blogs that I didn't mention when I was defining them is that nearly all blogs are very heavy on links. So, again, in the early days of the web, media sites were reluctant to link out. They thought it was bad for their business. If you were on a newspaper site and that newspaper linked to somebody else's site, the editor was afraid you'd never come back to his website. So they were very cautious about linking. Bloggers said, no, that's what I'm doing. You know, I'm going to compile lists of things that I think that I'm interested in that might interest you too. So that's another key part of the definition.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up about conflicting points of view, because one of the major criticisms of the existence of blogging in the world is that readers in particular can sort of find themselves in an echo chamber that exposes them only to writing that reinforces what they already believe. You don't see that as valid.
Well, it's an open debate at this point. My perspective is that certainly there are instant there are you can build your own echo chamber if you want. If you only want to get news and information from if you're a Democrat or a Republican and you want to choose to get your political information from a website that is partisan, you can now do that. You can do it more effectively than you could when I was growing up. If you go back further in history, of course, you find this that for the bulk of American history, most of the media was, in fact, partisan, and you had newspapers that, had affiliations with different parties. And it's only really in the mid-20th century that changed. So, the little historical sidelight. But the echo chamber is something that you can build for yourself, but the web also gives you the opportunity to break out of it. And what I find in my reading and in the people that I talk to is that we actually read more widely today of people who disagree with us than we could before. I'm liberal in my orientation. I never read the National Review when it was only on paper because I wasn't going to spend the money to buy a magazine that was going to raise my blood pressure and so forth. But today, if a blogger links to an article in the National Review that sounds interesting or that sounds like an argument that I should listen to because maybe it'll challenge my beliefs, I click on a link, there it is, I have that opportunity. So while I think the concerns about the echo chamber are real and are worth talking about, we should also know that the web is constantly giving us opportunities to challenge ourselves. And all you have to make that choice and click on the link to do it.
Well, it is important perspective, I think, when you talk about this sort of mid-20th century ethos of journalism. And it's sort of the way I was raised when I was being trained in this, and I'm sure that you were too. But it's not something that has been a factor forever.
Yeah, people, because journalism is going through this huge financial crisis today, people are beginning to kind of look up and explore the longer history of the field. And it's really fascinating because you see that the tenets of objectivity and the professionalism that we kind of take for granted as the norms of certainly American journalism since the 50s or so are really a fairly recent vintage, and they coincided with the development of larger and larger media businesses that were trying to be and became monopolies in their communities. So if you were trying to reach and serve everyone in your community, it became really important not to offend people, not to take positions that were going to challenge people too much. And so you wound up with a very successful but kind of denatured public sphere. And what we have today is the rebirth of a much more kind of raucous and anarchic, but also much more lively and I think ultimately more healthy public sphere on the web where many, many more points of view are being heard.
Are journalists, Scott, the only people obsessed with this question of who gets to call themselves a journalist?
I don't know. I think they are more obsessed, certainly. I think most people don't think of it as a question of what is journalism. Most people ask, and I think rightly so, what can I trust? Where can I find good information? And they don't really, it doesn't matter what label you hang on it. They just want to know, is this website, is this person, is this media business, is it something I can trust? And sadly, they have lost a lot of trust in the traditional news outlets, sometimes for spurious reasons, but sometimes for good reasons. And that's happening at the same time that this business meltdown is happening, and the combination is having some pretty severe results.
Scott Rosenberg is with us this hour. He's a co-founder and former managing editor of Salon.com. His new book is called Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. You can join us right now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We'll resume our conversation right after the break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Scott Rosenberg. He's a co-founder and former managing editor of Salon.com. His new book is called Say Everything: How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. If you want to be part of the discussion, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So we've talked already about the interest of the early blog writers. What do we know about the earliest audiences for blogs?
At the beginning, I think it's fair to say that there were two audiences. One was people who were just what you might call the early adopters of the technology world in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, people who were just really interested in new forms and new things that were emerging in the sort of petri dish of the web. And they got excited about it and told other people about it and kind of word spread. The other group was other bloggers. You know, it was normal that people who were doing this would link to other people who were doing it, and they formed gradually communities. And it's another area where I think journalists kind of got a bit of a skewed view, because journalists would look at this and say, see, the only people who are interested in what you're writing are other people who are doing what you're doing. That means it's not significant. And the people who were doing it said, well, wait a minute, that's your standard. Our standard is different. This is a community that we're forming, and we're not trying to reach other people necessarily. We're happy to reach these people.
You write in the book about a guy named Justin Hall, who you call the first oversharer before the term even existed. Can you talk about what he was writing about?
Yeah. He started a website. He was a 19-year-old college student in 1994. And at that time, the web was really largely composed of academic research. That's what the web was invented for people to share. And he looked at it and said, I could make a website, and it could be all about me. And that's what he did. The website that he created was called Links.net, and he did two things. He told his own stories. He posted pictures. Some of them were nude pictures of himself. And he also included lots of links to other people. And at that time, what he was doing was both unusual, unexpected, and also very influential. Other people looked at the site and said, hey, that's really kind of extraordinary. It looks like fun. Maybe I could do that. So this was before the form of blogs even existed, but what Justin Hall really did, I think, was kind of set a new default on the web. He took what was a primarily academic environment and turned it into more of a sort of playground for people to experiment with telling about themselves, revealing themselves, and sometimes, of course, revealing too much, which is kind of the way his story ends 10 years later. He gets involved in a relationship with a woman who looks at what he's doing and says, I don't want this to be a part of our lives. You know, it's the blog or it's me. He made the sensible human choice at that point.
Well, there's also this question for people who decide to blog about their personal lives about how much to reveal in terms of their actual identity.
Yeah, and anonymity is this amazing kind of double-edged concept with blogs, because a lot of the complaints we hear about blogging often arise from people who very understandably say, you know, how do I know who's writing this? Sometimes blogs are literally anonymous, or sometimes they have a name, but you don't know if that's someone's real name or whatever. And so the possibility of anonymity leads to a certain amount of distrust. On the other hand, the possibility of anonymity also allows for all sorts of stories to be told and information to come out that we wouldn't get access to otherwise. This is valuable, of course, in situations where we have whistleblowers trying to get information out, or in countries where there are repressive governments and people need the anonymity to protect themselves. But then for people who want to who believe in the sort of ideal of blogging, that blogging is about authenticity, that it's all about telling it like it is and being real on the web. It's a very powerful idea, and it inspires people, But then they find, well, wait a minute, you know, there are different spheres of my life that I'm kind of happy to keep separate. Do I want to be writing about, you know, some interest of mine that might be a little off the mainstream, and do I want my boss to know about that? All sorts of issues that today, large numbers of people are encountering these problems, these questions, because they're posting to Facebook, or they're on Twitter, or they're doing some other kind of social networking. And all of those dilemmas and questions are ones that people in blogging 10 years ago, 15 years ago, were already encountering. So one of my motivations in writing the book was to kind of tell those stories in a way that maybe we can all learn from. And one of the lessons is, I think very clearly, that you do have to draw boundaries, that you can't actually say everything.
Let's talk about Facebook and Twitter, because maybe to a certain extent they have supplanted the need for people who were blogging about what they ate for lunch that day and really mundane details of their lives. They've got another avenue for that now. But you actually see them as helping to sort of boil down to the blogosphere, to blogs that are much more substantive.
Yeah. You know, you see this division in blogging from the beginning. There were always two types of blog posts, really short links that people links and comments and observations about their daily life that people were posting, and also longer thoughts and ideas. And sometimes people even divided these into two sort of streams on their blogs. And it was a division that was always a part of the form. And today it's just much easier to do that stuff on Twitter and the shorter form kind of things, or on Facebook, or in some other using some other similar tool. And so what that, you know, some people have responded to that by saying, well, you know, they think this means that blogging is dead. But blogging is a successful media form. And whenever there's a successful media form, meaning one that's in really wide use, they almost never, we have very few examples of media forms that actually are sort of killed off by some subsequent development. You know, we still have live theater, even though film came along. We still have radio, even though television came along. And you can bet that at the time, you know, there were people saying that radio is dead or live theater is dead. What happens when a new form emerges is that it redefines the old form. And so in this case, I think what the social networks are doing is helping blogs refocus on more substantive issues, letting people really use them as records of their lives, that of the longer ideas and records of experiences that they really want to remember. And that's, I think, significant. It's also ironic because, of course, when blogging started in the late 90s, the first criticism to arise was that they were really trivial. You know, and they were not going to be important because people were just posting mindless trivialities from their lives. And it's 10 years later now, and we actually see blogging, emerging as a kind of where we work out our ideas in public. You know, in every kind of major public debate that we have right now, if you want to learn about them, the best way is to go find a few really good blogs and read them.
Lee Siegel comes up in the book, and the famous case in which he sort of went online and sock puppeted in defense of his own writing. I want to talk a little bit about the discourse element of this and the fact that sometimes it is one sort of exposed person who is writing the blog being commented to and with by people who may not ever have to reveal their identities. That's something that's a little bit different than the way we've done public discourse in the past.
For sure. I mean, comments, the original blogs didn't even have comments. Comments arose, they became the norm, I'd say, in the early part of this decade, and they have ever since been a source of delight for some people and consternation for others. The great thing about comments, of course, is that you get instant feedback, you get arguments that can be helpful, you get suggestions, you get people point out mistakes. It's a sort of self-correcting feedback loop, and that can be very valuable. On the other hand, you do have, depending on the nature of the subject you're writing, depending on who you've gathered to read what you're writing or who has linked to you, you can get a lot of really, you know, angry and sometimes abusive comments, and that can be upsetting and frustrating. the thing about blogging is that it always privileges the blogger's voice, right? You have the post. The comments are in some subsidiary position to the post. And you also are the moderator. You can delete things. In the earliest days of the web, there was an ideology that, you know, you shouldn't delete anything because it's free speech. But today we see that you're not eliminating someone's free speech by deleting their comment on your blog. Nothing can stop that person from starting his or her own blog. You're not restricting their freedom of speech. You are moderating a discussion, and that's pretty widely accepted now, too. So as long as you sort of take that on that role, you think that you can think of your blog as, a party that you're holding, and you're going to throw people out if they're rowdy, that's one useful way of thinking about it.
We have an email here from Eric in Colleyville who thinks that blogs are losing their relevance and wants to know your thoughts on this idea. Since they are a one-way communication tool, they will always be of less value to the reader than forums, which allow individual users to add their own voices to the conversation. It's similar to what we were discussing, but a slightly different take.
Yeah. Well, forums actually existed even before the web. I was a member of one called The Well, which was an early online community that still exists, and the forums were a wonderful sort of early testing ground for how to build community online, and it's still a great format. The difference in a forum is that it's easy for the individual voice to get drowned out. Blogs, I disagree. I wouldn't define them as a one-way communication tool because even if you don't have comments, they're not a one-way tool because the conversation takes place between blogs. I post something on my blog, somebody else links to it and takes issue with something I said. I might see that and respond. So blogs have never really been one-way, but they are, I think, a really effective way to balance the forces that can really overwhelm a single voice in a conversation online, in mailing lists too. If you've ever been on an email mailing list, you know that it's very easy for people to gang up on someone who's expressing a controversial point of view, and it can be hard for those points of view to be heard. And blogs kind of redress that balance a little bit.
We have an email here from Barry, who identifies himself as a contributor to Open Salon, and you can tell us a little bit about that in a minute. Barry wants to know what you think of the evolution of Open Salon and where you think it might be headed.
Open Salon is a great blogging space that Salon.com developed. I participated in conceiving it before I left the company a couple of years ago, and any reader of Salon.com can start a blog there, and it's also a really healthy community in which the conversation is spirited, but people are not flinging abuse at each other, and it's a great achievement, I think, on that level. And it's an example of what I think we're going to see more and more of from, Salon is sort of a more traditional online media outlet. It pays reporters to do reporting and, has a long record of great journalism. And Open Salon is sort of like a great bridge between that professional journalism on Salon and the kind of completely, sort of the wilds of the open web. It's a kind of an experiment in blogging community that I think is really worth checking out. It's at open.salon.com for people who are interested.
I'm going to ask you to make a gross generalization here, but you have read a lot more blogs than probably a lot of us have. How often is blog writing quality writing?
There's a couple of different ways to respond to that. I mean, of course, it begs the question, what do we mean by quality writing? There are, there are traditions of literary writing that most blogs don't achieve. On the other hand, how much of the writing in your daily newspaper is, achieving that? It it's hard to say. Often not as much as one would like. I prefer not to think of quality writing than to think of two other things. One is quality of information. If there's factual information being presented, can you trust it? And the other is just liveliness and level of engagement. There are some blogs with millions of people blogging today. It's unrealistic to expect or to want them all to match a single standard of literary value that emerges from some 19th century you know, tradition of literacy. We have many different kinds of literacy today. And, you know, to me, really, if you want, I mean, there are actually wonderful literary blogs, and there are, you know, more, there's probably, in total, more quality writing on the web, you know, according to whatever the cliched traditional sense of quality might be, than anywhere else. But it's a tiny fraction of the writing out there, and it's not necessarily what you're going to stumble upon as the first results in Google on some search.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Scott Rosenberg about his book, Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. Let's go on the phones to Andrew in Dallas. Hey, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, my question is about blogging as it relates to journalism. Scott said that one of the bigger questions is whether or not people can trust a given blog. I wanted to know more about how he sees a layman who's not trained in journalism, who doesn't know anything about journalism, and the kind of ethos you guys were talking about. How do they know whether the blogger is trustworthy, whether they know what they're doing well enough to give them accurate information?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we need and are slowly developing better systems for doing that. At the moment, you have a couple of options. One is to read the blog and see how much of the information that the blogger is presenting is linked out to sources. In other words, if somebody makes an assertion, do they link to something else, and does that link lead somewhere that makes sense to you? You know, if somebody is saying, quoting a public official, is that quote on the record somewhere else that you trust? And that's often a good good yardstick. Another thing is to see who's linking to that blog, and there are tools you can use to do that. But ultimately, what we need are better tools that are websites that actually help you understand through different technical and social means what a particular blogger's reputation is. And we're beginning to get some of those, but we've got a ways to go.
Scott Rosenberg is with us. His new book is called Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is co-founder and former managing editor of Salon.com, Scott Rosenberg. His new book is called Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending an email to think@kera.org. Is there a typical life cycle for a blog?
I think there is, and it's one that is governed by, you know, it parallels the life cycle of any, you know, living thing. It starts with most blogs that have any longevity start with a burst of excitement. Somebody gets an idea to do something, and whether it's to, you know, chronicle a project or tell stories from their life or vent on some public issue, they go at it, they discover that they're good at it or that they enjoy it, that people are responding well and they're encouraged to do more, and they do it for months or years, and then at some point that energy runs out. And maybe it's because they got what they wanted when they started the blog, they achieved some goal, or maybe it's because they find that they're not achieving the goal and time to move on. But at some point, you know, there's a point where the person says, I've done this enough, I'm going to do something else. And that's, you know, I think normal and natural and good.
obviously, anyone who's tried to blog knows that it takes a lot of time and effort if you're going to contribute on a regular basis. Can you talk about some of the challenges that exist for professional writers? And you sort of write about these people in the book who already have a venue somewhere else but are expected to supplement whatever they're publishing in hard copy with blogging.
So this, you mean if it's part of their work, it's added as like an additional responsibility?
Right.
Well, that's, you know... There's a good side and a bad side to it. The good side is that if you're blogging, you're going to become more agile at responding to the feedback that you get. You're going to begin to understand the environment on the web, which you probably need to understand if you don't already. And so there's good experience to be gotten from it. But of course, if it's part of just a speed up of your work, if you're still doing the same work you always did before, and then you're also asked to do a blog on the side, ultimately, I think everything that you do is going to suffer. So it's a little unrealistic.
Is there anything that is any sort of project that you know of that's preserving blogs that have been taken offline so that someday we'll have a record of what the discourse really looked like at this time in history?
Well, there is a great resource called the Internet Archive. It's at archive.org, and it has been taking snapshots of the web since around 1997. Huh. And I was of invaluable use to me in writing this book. And so that's, you know, sort of the baseline for archival work on this stuff. And it's really important, I think, because what we're doing in writing all of these millions of blogs is laying a kind of rich sediment for historians of the future to dig through. You know, the record of our lives is going to be so much broader and deeper than anything that really people have had to work from in the past. And since we now, generally think of history as being not just a record of, say, what governments do, but a record of what people and any group of people do and how people actually live their lives, I think that's going to be extraordinarily important.
You have a really interesting response in the book to the criticism that blogging is really just a form of narcissism writ large across the Internet. I was going to say, will you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, narcissism is one of these all-purpose kind of...
Put downs.
And you know, sometimes it's true. There's no question that some of the blogs you might stumble on, you might think, boy, this person is really just only interested in him or herself. But the other thing we have to remember is that a lot of people aren't using blogs to try to reach a really wide audience. They're communicating with a small group. And if you think of blogging as being a kind of interesting hybrid of television and of the telephone. You know, we always use the television as the metaphor for what the web is like as the image, because it's on a screen and it has some aspects that remind us of television. But if you think of, there's a telephonic element where really we're just trying to communicate with a small group. Maybe something we say might reach a wider group because the web allows that, but that's not what we're after. Then this complaint of narcissism is sort of irrelevant. And the other piece of it is that because the web is open and because there's sort of an infinite amount of space on it, somebody, the narcissist down the block who's writing stuff that I think is really pointless, isn't crowding anyone else's voice out. And that's really important to remember, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Do you think that blogging is changing traditional media?
It certainly is, for two reasons. One is that it has shown, I think, the traditional media that personal voice really does matter on the web. That it is something that you have to allow back in to the work of media professionals, and that's had a huge impact. And the other part of it is sort of a more complex part of the business story, which is that, you know, most blogs are not produced for money. They're produced for love. And as a result, but they still capture some portion of people's attention. and the time that people are spending on the web reading this content that is created out of love is affecting the business, because the media business is losing some, you know, probably at this point modest but still significant mind share and you know, eyeball share to people who are not expecting pay for their writing. And so that is just compounding other financial issues that are already afflicting media companies.
We had the call earlier asking about sort of establishing the veracity of a blog that you might decide to read. There have been several high-profile cases of bloggers who were found out to be fraudulent, telling stories that weren't true and not putting this out there as any kind of fiction, but saying this is my life. Do you think, as much as anything, that these have just caused readers to go into anything they read on the web with a more skeptical eye?
Well, if it has, I think that's good. I mean, I think skepticism is always good thing. It never hurts to, you know, wonder, you know, if we know that, I mean, there were some really amazing blogs that people were reading during the start of the Iraq War in 2003, where American readers could actually read posts from people in Baghdad. And some of the readers of that, you know, raised one thought, well, how do we know that this person is in Baghdad? And there were certain technical tricks that you could use to, you know, check out the internet addresses and see, and ultimately in the highest profile case, a blog called Where Is Riyadh that a lot of people read, we got, you know, the blogger sort of uncloaked himself and we learned who he was, and he was indeed in Baghdad, and so, you know, skepticism is good, but it cuts both ways. You know, I think people, thoughtful readers have begun to be more skeptical about what they read in the professional media. To go back to that same point in history, of course, we know that a lot of what we read in the mainstream media in the run-up to the Iraq War, sadly, was not true. And the press did not do a good job of questioning what it was told by the government at that time. And a lot of people became more skeptical, I think, from that experience and from others that they've had, you know, about the media as well. So to having, I mean, skepticism in all directions, I think, is just always a good baseline to start from.
Beyond sort of regulating pornographic material and things like that, is there any sense in even trying to regulate the content of these things?
Well, you know, there's regulation that already exists in the broadest sense, in that when you publish on a blog, you're still subject to the libel laws. You're subject to the copyright laws. You know, the legal structure is not totally caught up with the web, and there are certainly holes in it, but it still applies. So that's, you know, that's one thing that is still in place.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Alex in Plano. Hello, Alex.
Hi. I had a question. You were talking earlier, Scott, about blogs being used as very intricate historical records, you know, from the people. I was wondering if you had any concerns about blogging being an electronic medium, and if those records could be, I don't know, corrupted or destroyed if you just pull the plug on them at some point.
Yeah. Well, there's this, you know, we have this kind of dual notion of how long-lasting electronic records are, because on the one hand, we all know from our experience with our own PCs that, you know, you can lose it all in a flash, and that's kind of scary. Stuff that's on the web, it tends to be less fragile because there are lots of copies of it, and there's this Internet Archive that I mentioned, which is certainly one important resource. There are also, you know, often other copies in other places, and I'm actually more confident that the stuff I'm writing on the web today will outlive me than the articles I wrote for a newspaper in the 1980s, you know, many of which are kind of hard to find today. They're locked behind, you know, they're in a database somewhere, but the company that owns that database could go out of business. So, you know, all information is subject to a kind of a half-life, but the stuff that's public and that has multiple copies tends to survive best.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send us email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Dick in Arlington. Hey, Dick.
Hey, I just like to get the guy to say something about commercial blogs, businesses that are conducting business on the internet and using blogs.
Yeah, I mean a lot of businesses have found it enormously helpful to create a blog, use it as a way to talk about what they're up to, what's new in their field, develop a reputation on the web as a result, and have a conversation with their customers. So this has been a hugely successful movement in a lot of fields, I think. Businesses have to be a little bit careful to, you know, understand that the blog is not going to be effective if it's just kind of an advertisement for their work, that if the more that they're honest and forthright with their customers in a blog, the more successful it will be. But a lot of small companies have lifted their profiles by doing this, and a lot of big companies have found that they've been able to sort of humanize their public face by letting employees blog. Sometimes they get into a little trouble. People, you know, step outside of the corporate line, and companies sort of throw up their hands and don't know what to do, or they chastise the employee, or, you know, which can get ugly. But usually it's effective because it tells the public that the company's actually interested in having a conversation with the rest of the world.
Can you talk for a minute about the kinds of blogs that you read in the course of doing research for this book that you might not otherwise have been interested in?
Well, what I found was that there are blogs in all sorts of fields where people are just pursuing an overwhelming passion for a subject. It might be, there are huge communities of people who knit, who are bloggers. There are people, who are dedicated to gourmet food and how to cook particular kinds of things. And what I've learned was that as long as someone is really passionate about something, it can be interesting to read about almost anything. If it helps, if they have some talent, if they have some humor, if they're, adroit with a sentence, that's even better.
Has any of this affected the kinds of things that you blog about?
Well, I've been blogging now for 7 years, and my blog is really a pretty traditional outlet for my thoughts about the web, and I can't say it's really changed from the work on the book, except that I blogged a lot less while I was working on the book, because there are only so many hours in the day.
Yeah, it's funny. By the time people are writing and reading, there's not a lot of other spare time for other activities.
Well, it is addictive in that sense, and that's, it can be painful, but it's also a sign that there's something there.
Scott Rosenberg is a co-founder and former managing editor of Salon.com. His new book is called Say Everything, How Blogging Began and What It's Becoming and Why It Matters. Scott, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks a lot.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.